2007, a Monday. We're going to have a walkthrough through the dash twos of Senate Bill 329. I'm going to ask my co-chair to make a few comments if you'd like first.
Well, first I think we should have a report from staff, Mr. Co-chair.
Staff?
Thank you. Just briefly, at the dais in your packet is a bulleted summary of Senate Bill 329 and the dash two amendments. At the table, we had an additional bulleted summary. It says dash one amendments. Those are no longer valid. There are no dash one amendments to the bill. The only amendments out so far are the dash two, so you can scrap those dash ones and look at the dash twos. At that, Mr. Chair, that is my report.
Thank you, Rick. We're going to walk through the 329s tonight. I'm going to ask that members of the committee who wish to ask questions do so as we go along. Quite often we want to be sure that, what our intent is, what's written on the page. You can help us with that as we go through it. I believe most people will find not any huge surprises in this bill, at least I hope not, because we've been talking about this for a long time. But now we're kind of getting down to it. We expect to have a walkthrough tonight, followed by our first testimony on the bill on Wednesday night. And that testimony will go on for a couple of sessions. But I expect that we'll see potentially some changes. But overall, we know what we're looking at here. It shouldn't be a big surprise for anybody. Mr. Co-Chair, any questions? Any comments?
Well, not any questions, but I do think a general comment, I think, is we all go through this tonight. You will see that, as we intended, this is a compilation of parts of all four bills, three bills and proposal that were before us. I think there's, we have pretty well achieved kind of the best and attainable ideas out of all four of those bills. And it does incent what we started out to do, which is, you know, three broad guiding stars. We need to lower cost, improve quality, and provide access to every Oregonian. And within that, provide a framework that allows individuals to choose their own doctor, have portable insurance, and where Oregonians need not be concerned about pre-existing conditions. That's what we were trying to achieve with this. So with that, let's start the deliberative process. Okay. And turn it over to our very qualified LC staff.
And just before we get started, I think I'll make a comment about one thing which most people will readily see is not in this bill. I'm gonna do what I call a preemptive strike. You'll note that Medicare is not in this bill. And, you know, I relate this to something that, since I'm kind of a history buff about World War II, that something happened in World War II. About halfway through the campaign in Europe, the commanding general for the Brits wanted to go ahead and do a special way of attacking Germany by taking out three or four bridges and running across those bridges and directly into Germany. They made a movie out of it called A Bridge Too Far. Did Germany need to be defeated? Did we need to win World War II? Absolutely. Was that the right way to do it? No, it was a bridge too far. And we ultimately won that war. We're ultimately going to win this war. But my position right now is that Medicare is a bridge too far. And I'm not going to say any more on that topic tonight. Lori, would you start us up, please?
Sure.
And please try not to break the, utensils.
I already have. Chair Bates, members of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'm here to go through the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 329. I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. Rick Berkobian's done a wonderful little summary here that I think hits all the highlights, but please feel free to ask questions as I move through this. The preamble, which is the first three some pages, has been replaced by this new language, which was sort of a mix from Senate Bill 27 and what was in this bill currently. And then Section 1 names this the Oregon Better Health Act. Section 2 is definitions. The only changes here are to the safety net provider. We've added that as a definition. The Section 3 is the principles. Section 4 are the goals, and we set those out, then later sections will cross-reference the goals or the principles. 5 is the board, which now, I think the original 329 was 15, and now it's down to 7. With just sort of general areas of expertise rather than a representation of various interests. And Section 6 is not a change. That's the staggered board terms. Section 7 requires the governor to appoint an executive director within 30 days of the effective date of the act, and the act has an emergency clause effective on passage. And the idea here is just to get somebody to get the office up and running, and then once the board is confirmed, they are to, 30 days after the board is confirmed, then the person who is appointed by the governor, his or her term expires, and a new executive director is to be appointed by the board. It could be the same person. And let's see, Section 9 is the same. Section 10 is the Oregon Health Fund, which is just about the same as Senate Bill 329, except that we've taken out the reference to Title 18, which is Medicare. Section 11 is really what I think see as the meat of the bill, and that's where the Oregon Health Trust Board is to develop a comprehensive plan to achieve the program goals. A number of subcommittees to look at. We'll look at Rick's summary here because that was helpful. Financing. Which is collecting contributions, collecting the value of public subsidies, addressing medical liability. And then the second charge is delivery, including looking at an efficient delivery system model, information technology, and so forth. The third charge is to determine benefits, and this is the defined set of essential health services, how to come up with it, how to update it, and then all of the information about the accountable health plans that we had in the original 329 are sort of left up to the committee in this bill to come up with a plan for implementing that public-private partnership. And then finally, eligibility. Once the subcommittees complete their work, they have to make a report. They have to come up with a comprehensive plan and submit it by October 1st of 2008. And they have the authority to go directly to the Legislative Council office and have the comprehensive proposal be drawn up into a bill to be proposed to the 09 Legislative Assembly. And then in Section 14, we set up a requirement for the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to develop a 5-year evaluation plan. This is similar to the plan that was in House Bill 3368. Section 15 is the Oregon Health Trust Board is charged with establishing a statewide toll-free number to help uninsured people connect to federally qualified health centers, safety net clinics, and so forth. In Section 16, we're transferring the Oregon Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research from where it's currently in Department of Administrative Services. This transfers it over to the Oregon Health Trust Board. Section 18 is just a conform. Oh, wait a minute. I went too far. Here we go. Section 17 moves the process for determining certificate of need from the Department of Human Services over to the Oregon Health Trust Board. And then 18 is a conforming amendment. Section 19 gives a general fund appropriation to the board. Section 20 is a delayed operative date on a number of the provisions so that they are triggered when the board is confirmed by the Senate. Section 21 sunsets all the committees as of January 2nd, 2009, and 22 is the emergency clause.
Well, that's a pretty straightforward and simple thing. We can all go home now. Appreciate it, folks.
Any objections? Seeing none.
All right, great. We're out of here. Thank you, Lori, for a quick high-level overview. We're going to stop and go back through section by section now, starting with section 2. Yeah, I'd like the committee to, I know this just came out, and frankly, it came out late last night. We've got 5 or 6 meetings left, I believe, and we need to get this work done now. So I have a question on Section 2 for you, Lori, and I'm sure others will have the other questions as we go along. On line 14, page 4, ORS 743.730, this is trying to define an accountable health plan. How does this affect the FCHIPS? They come under 743.730? Or are they under a different statute?
They could. 743.730 includes managed care contractors. Okay. So
it's the intent of this bill that we not affect the FCHIPS in a negative fashion. We want them to continue in their present status, and frankly, we'll probably be ensuring more lives under their present status. Do we address that in this bill?
Yes. Chair Bates, I think I'm trying to find there's somewhere where we make sure that the people who are subject to, who are under the Oregon health plan remain with the federally fully capitated health plans. Give me a minute, I'll try to find that.
Well, we can research that later, but we want to make sure we're clear about that ultimately. So I'll make a note about that and get back to you, okay?
Sure. Yeah, this is the definition, and somewhere else, Mr. Chair, we make it clear that under 414 they aren't subject to the new public-private partnership, that those people remain with the fully capitated health plans.
Okay. Committee, I think that unless there's questions about section 3 and section 4, which there may well be, I'd like to go to section 5 just for a moment and have a discussion about the makeup of the Oregon Health Trust board. As we all know, we've grappled with this for a year and a half. Well, it's been a wide open discussion. The desire was to make this an apolitical board as much as possible. And in doing so, we've outlined here a very different kind of board that you'd normally see for this type of organization. We've talked about that before. It's here in black and white now. I'd like to have comment from everybody. We could have put physicians, nurses, insurers, hospital representatives on this board. We chose in this to put them into those four underlying very important statutory committees to give their expertise to the board. We're really looking for 7 wise men and women to put into this board who can take that input and turn it into a plan that really makes sense, not for hospitals, not for doctors, not for nurses, but for Oregonians. And so I'd like to have some comment from board, from the committee members of Fonda.
Mr. Chair, I think it wasn't just our characterization, but this committee's characterization as well, and what you and I and many of us at attendance at this dais tonight when we were out on the on our town halls describing what was going on in this bill and what did citizens want, that it became very clear to us that the key component of the board should be formed by the answer to this question that you've all heard me ask before, but it's who does this board represent? And for us, it wasn't the providers. It represents consumers, citizens, aka consumers, and those who pay the bill. We heard that time and time again. So I think that's the fair way to characterize how this became configured the way it did.
Thank you. Senator Morstead.
I like this copy of the amendment better. I'm assuming the language is the same in the draft in this. Anyway, they're the same. As I understand it, the board member will serve for 4 years, and that's it. One term. Is that true?
They can be reappointed.
Does it say that?
Yes.
Yes. It says the member is eligible for reappointment.
Oh, okay.
Line 20. I realize it's a hard.
Oh, okay,
it's
this
kind of new
may
here,
not.
So.
Line what? Where are we?
It's page 7, line 22. It's under section 5.
Okay, you're right. I didn't see that in the other one, but I do see it here. Okay, that was my question. Just
that's why we like the dash G bill. It's bigger print.
I understand the draft is not the same as the amendment.
That's correct.
Oh, the member is eligible for reappointment. It is. Okay, I'm sorry.
We also like the bigger print for some of us. Okay.
Good.
As
okay, that was my
Senator
question.
Wessel just said.
Okay, that leads to the question then. How many terms are they eligible to be reappointed for? Could they conceivably be reappointed for 5, 6, 7 terms for life?
Absolutely.
So
we want continuity, and we want this, again, as I said before, to be apolitical. We know how badly that can happen. So we're trying to avoid that as
There's
much as
no
possible.
There's no limit on the number of terms a person may serve. That has a downside as well.
It certainly does.
Okay.
And not just for the individual.
Well, no, I'm talking about the body.
I understand. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the one part of the bill that I do have some real concerns about, and it has to do with the responsibility of the board from a governance standpoint. Is it operational or is it policy? And the way I read this bill, the way it's constructed, it would follow the lines more of the PUC model, where you have salaried directors, so to speak, the Public Utility Commission, and they are salaried and they're working members. And the way I read this bill, where you have the statement that the governor shall fix their salaries, I think the model I would be more comfortable with is one where it's truly a policy board, more in like in kind with the SAFE board, where expenses are reimbursed but they're not salaried. And then you have a director who is, in fact, salaried and a staff who is salaried, as opposed to a 7-member board that is salaried. And I can see a growing overhead cost that that might not be necessary. And if I'm reading this incorrectly, then help me. But this is the way I read it, and that is a major concern for me.
Senator Morris, we actually, again, agonized over whether this should be a salaried, not salaried position, whether it should be a board that meets once a month or every other month, and this looks at high-level policy, or this should be more of a management team that works directly with the health industry. They'll be overseeing potentially a $10 to $14 billion annual industry, one that now has no direction to it of any significance in many areas. And it was the sense of all the discussion we've had for the last year and a half that this needs to be a fairly professional board taking significant input from those underlying committees. We're thinking more of a PUC model times. We thought of the Federal Reserve model times, too. But this is going to be an extremely important board if we're going to bring cost under control, obtain better outcomes. Kind of boards some of us think about are hospital boards, which you sit on. They're policy boards. And you have a professional staff that runs the hospital. We felt that from the testimony we've taken and what we've heard, that we probably need a bit more than that. And that's a break with the usual boards you see in other areas. We will discuss this more, and we'll have more conversations about it. I'd like to have you kind of try to wrap your arms around, think about some more, and give us some more feedback. We'll be talking about it more the next 2 or 3 days, and I'd love to hear more about what you have to think and what your thinking is on it. This is the reason I went to Section 5 right off the bat is because I think this is a real key part of this bill, if not the key part. What that board looks like, how it functions, is extremely important if we're going to bring healthcare costs under control, maintain access, and get some quality issues taken care of.
If I might follow up.
Yes, sir.
I see this on the front end. It's actually probably phased. The front end is putting the flesh to the skeleton, and that's the task. And then it reports back to the Legislative Assembly with, in fact, implementing major requests. So there's a checkpoint along the way in terms of getting the biggest bang for the buck. I see the dollars that would go into salaries actually should go into consultants that are retained in their areas of expertise that help craft this. It's not in an operational mode on the front end. And to assume that these seven members would be, in fact, have the operational expertise on the front end might be, well, number one, how do we find them? And what do we have to pay them to make this a full-time position, as opposed to thinking about more of a policy-driven and then reaching out and bringing in those folks that we have to have in order to craft the ultimate eventual plan.
We discussed also, I think you're leading the same discussion we had before, do you actually have two things going on here? One, something to set this up and get it in place, and then a different group that actually goes forward from there and manages the system from that point forward. We debated this back and forth. We decided that we need to bring in, number one, a professional chief executive officer immediately on enactment, because it'll take months to get these people selected through the process of having the governor select them and through confirmation. And once there, I believe the amount of work they have to do in the first year and a half is huge and will require close, I think, to full-time commitment. After that, you may have, from my point of view only, you may have a very valid point. This board may have to step back and be more of a policy board with a professional team under it. But initially, I think this clearly needs to be here. The amount of work to get done to set up a board that is really going to have these kind of functions, I just don't see how they can do it in a meeting once a month, once a week, once every other week. I think it's a full-time requirement from them. And I think you have to compensate the kind of people you're looking for to do this. I would entertain a thought from you, though, that Once this is up and functioning, that board's position might change.
Right. The compensation issue, obviously we have to have qualified people. But in the business world, the vernacular is the burn rate. If you're starting something up, what's your burn rate? And that's before you ever produce a nickel. What's your overhead and your implementing costs to get you to where you want to go? And I see the implementing side of this best done reaching out and grabbing those expertise as it's needed, not on an employment basis, but on a essentially the best people we can find that are willing to come in, you know, on a for services paid to do the job, and then they're released. But under the guidance of a policy board that is monitoring all of these activities, rather than trying to find seven people with the expertise with an unknown future, because this whole thing, as it is implemented and presented back to the legislature for final approval, it may or may not fly. So there's a great deal of uncertainty for someone with a high degree of professional expertise commit themselves to this in that circumstance. So I see this in a little different shift, still accomplishing the same things, but doing it a little differently.
And frankly, we had the same discussion about your chief executive officer. You're asking somebody to come in and work really hard for a year and a half. But that board ultimately is to decide whether that person stays on or not. And so we're looking for someone there who is willing to come in on the kind of basis you're talking about also. And how you compensate them and what they're offered is important. Good comments. We'll think about it. This is something we've agonized over, and that's why I went there. Thank you, Senator Morris. Other discussion? Representative Cannon.
Thank you. I appreciate the way this board turned out. I think seven is a good number, and I think the fact that they're appointed to represent a stakeholder group is positive. I would submit perhaps their first task should be to imagine designing a board to represent the various interests, and what would those be, and which stakeholders would it need to include. And I suspect they'll get to that pretty quickly as they begin to develop these subcommittees, but they should be in that process considering the range of needs and folks who represent them out there. So I think that the process that you underwent in your conversations about what a stakeholder group would look like are really important ones, and that ones that this group of seven should undertake pretty quickly. I think it's a good board.
Pretty easy conversation here tonight, folks. Senator Mons Anderson.
Thank you. The first thing when I saw Section 5 is the fiscal. And I was trying to determine, do we want to have a PERS board, something like PUC or the PERS, or like SAFE? And I've always tended to migrate toward more of a public-private, but I'm not sure that's truly what we as a body want, because I think I get the consensus that you want everything truly reported back to the legislature, at least in the beginning phases. But it does put a lot of power in the governor's hands at this point, and I know the Senate has to approve in determining the people who will serve on this board. I think the stars are aligned in a sense that with the Office of Public of the Policy, Health Policy and Research, they're very well established, and the participation that Dr. Goldberg had played in the past on that. So I guess I'm not really too concerned at this point juncture putting all the power in the governor with those people at the helm. But again, I'd like to know what the fiscal is, because if we do get these outstanding people Are they going to be like a CEO of one of our hospitals that demands that kind of salary? No.
I think that's not
the caliber of person I'm trying to envision running this show.
They'll be more like legislators.
That caliber.
I'm afraid the caliber might be something we're sorely lacking.
Or like Frank, who's agreed to take the big salary and donate it back to the board to buy consultants.
Right. Further comments? I know there's a lot to digest in one night. I'm just asking is to take a quick look at it. I don't expect any final resolution, obviously, tonight. I would like to take the prerogative to take a look at another section, and I'm trying to hit the sections that I think might generate the most concerns, the most thought, and I may be wrong in doing this, but I'd like to move to Section 11, if we could, for a moment. These are the subcommittees. Subcommittees, I believe, are extremely important in this process because they're going to bring the expertise we need. I see these subcommittees having physicians, nurses, hospital administrators, the health insurance industry, all on each of these committees, frankly, and making very significant recommendations to the board. Do not expect the board to have the kind of expertise that each of these would bring to them. And to me, this is, again, goes right to the heart of this plan. If you haven't got this kind of process going on, you will not get to where you need to get to as far as the things this plan is supposed to do, access and cost control. We devised four broad committees. The board has a right to dissolve these committees, to form new committees as they need, but we wanted to be very clear that in the beginning we're worried about financing, the delivery of health care, a committee for benefits, and then the question of eligibility. And we wrapped into each of these things much of the language we've seen from the other two bills, both 329 and 27, and some of the concepts that were in the Health Policy Commission and in the OBC paper. You've not seen this language before in this format, but it's not new language to you. And I'd like to have you take a quick look at it as we speak. Lori, my memory of this is that this has the language in it for some of the boards or some of the agencies that might be coming over. Is that correct?
I'm sorry,
under
Mr.
Section
Chair.
11 we have in it is...
No, I don't believe so. That's at the end. That's Section 16, 17,
and 18. This Section 11 sets up the four safe harbor work groups, finance, delivery, benefits, and eligibility.
I agree, but unless I'm mistaken, I thought this was also part of the board's responsibility for integrating and streamlining, and in that we had some boards brought over, some agencies brought over. Is that, am I incorrect in that?
Mr. Chair, there the...
Page 11?
Yeah.
Section 11 starts on page 9 and runs through 10, 11.
One of the charges to the committee is to look at integrating and streamlining the functions of all the different state agencies involved in health planning and policy, health insurance, and delivery of health care services. That's subsection E, or paragraph E, that starts at the top of page 11. So while you have the Office of Oregon Health Policy coming over in later sections, still the committees are going to be looking at, are we really configuring this to maximize the effectiveness of all these different agencies that are involved in the area, and coming up with a recommendation how we might reconfigure those agencies or at least integrate and streamline them.
Thank you, Lori. what I like to point out on page 11 is one of the problems we have in healthcare. We've just listed those first agencies we think of that, and there's probably others we've missed that have an impact on how healthcare is delivered in this state. Simply the number of them being listed here, I think, indicates one of the problems we have with a dysfunctional system that does not fit together. There's bits and pieces of it all over state government, all over private industry. And what we've done here is ask that the board ultimately look at these, not take them over, not have authority over them, but try to bring them together to start functioning together. There's a big difference there. I've already had questions in the short time this has been out that the board is assuming the responsibility for these and authority over them. That is not what's stated here. This is an attempt to bring some coordination to a very complex system. Senator Morissette.
Well, I don't see the Office of Rural Health.
Told you I missed one.
Which is one of the most important.
I put on Rural Health. And then drug and alcohol addictions.
And
mental health. We don't really have them.
We are making notes.
Well, drug, alcohol, mental health together.
Some of that comes under Medicaid, some of it doesn't. There's bits and pieces everywhere, but we can list those specifically.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the language, the lead-in to that section was intended to be broad enough so that the board would be able to pick up all these other agencies that aren't specifically listed.
May include, but are not limited to.
Right. There's within DHS, there's also an Office of Health Planning that isn't statutory, but I would see that coming under the purview of this subcommittee's work.
All of DHS?
Mm-hmm. It's the same language again, including but not limited to. Same language again, including but not limited to. But they're not taking over authority for these. They're trying to coordinate these, which is something we've not achieved. That's what we're trying to point out here.
Where does it say that?
It's not taking over authority. It's attempting to integrate and streamline the function of these programs.
Looking at page 11 under E.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Integrating the streamlining the functions of the programs administered by all state agencies involved in health planning, policy, health insurance, and delivery of health care services.
Correct.
Integrating and streamlining, but not taking a moment.
They don't have. We are not giving in this bill authority over these. They don't report to the board.
Sounds like it is.
Well, integrating and streamlining to me is not authority, but maybe we're doing semantics here.
What power does the board have to integrate and streamline these functions? I mean, how's the board going to reorganize DHS if it doesn't have power to reorganize DHS, which clearly needs reorganization?
My assumption would be that they would make a policy decision and present it to the legislature, and the legislature accepted it. It would be enacted.
So this should say make recommendations about integrating and streamlining?
Well, Mitch, back on 10.
Page 10.
Page 10.
Okay.
It said...
reference, please, the section.
To what?
19. Line 19. It says delivering health services in the Oregon Health Fund program, including... but not limited to proposals for, and then under that sub B, you go A, B, C, D, and then you get to E where they're to come up with recommendations for integrating and streamlining.
I see. Yeah.
Delivering health services in the Oregon Health Fund program, that's delivering health services, including but not limited to proposals for.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the lead into this whole section is actually line one of that page. Starting on 9, that the board shall establish subcommittees configured to maximize efficiency and effectiveness.
Oops, you lost me. Well, look, what page are you on?
Starting on page 9 and then going over to 10.
Go to section.
Page 9.
Section 11. Starting on page 9. Line 29 is the lead-in for all of these subsections. They are to develop recommendations for all of the following, and then A is financing, B is delivery, and this is a subsection of delivery.
So none of these things in E are to report to the board, is that right?
No, I would expect the board would ask them to come in. They'll probably have hearings and discussions with them. And any recommendations or proposals would probably have to be enacted to a great degree in order to be obtained. But we're not giving them that authority through this bill to take over these agencies and direct them.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cannon.
It seems to me, with Lori's help, if anything, we've been overcautious here, because what this section seems to say is that the subcommittees will make recommendations on proposals for integrating and streamlining. I mean, we've really put this behind a couple of doors here. They're not going to integrate and streamline. They're going to make recommendations on proposals for integrating and streamlining. I mean, which should satisfy anyone who's concerned that the point is to sort of take these over or exercise authority. My concern would actually be on the other side, that they're behind a couple of closed doors here, these sort of the agencies listed on page 11. Is that sort of correct interpretation of how this is written?
Chair Bates, Representative Cannon, that is correct. The subcommittees are to come up with recommendations, which would include a recommendation for streamlining these agencies, and then that recommendation goes to the board, and the board has a public hearing, and then after the public hearing finalizes the comprehensive plan, which may or may not include this, which goes to the legislature.
A lot of study and reporting and writing and paperwork, which is maybe what's needed. But
this is a very complex system we're trying to change and bring together. And I think it's going to take a huge effort to do that, a lot of careful study and thoughtful study by our professional staff, and very hard work by these committees to come up with a proposal to really move this forward. And I don't think we want to give a board that kind of power just to make sweeping changes without them bringing it back to the legislature after careful thought. Saw another hand down here. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some language.
Right, Mr. Senator, you're going to be on this board before you say much more. I mean, I know, before you go down the road too far and criticize us, you realize you're going to be on the board, right? Okay, I just wanted to let you know that right off the bat.
I'm going to be off fishing.
Well, we've actually talked to your wife. You're not going to be.
Linda said it's okay.
Just as a, and this gets into the realm of wordsmithing, I know, but the words integrating and streamlining could be amplified to draw in a little more support from our members, because one of the things I've heard expressed is that this is additive to agencies and functions, and it's not replacing agencies and functions. So to the extent that we're integrating and streamlining and identifying those agencies and functions that in fact can be sunsetted, that are absorbed into this, I think it gives will give some members greater comfort that this is not an additive agency.
I agree. We've actually had that discussion also, and the overlap of all these agencies and ones we haven't even thought of or haven't thought of putting in here goes directly to that. And the amount of overlay and bureaucratic haze we have to work through in the healthcare system is really absolutely amazing. All put in with good intentions over many, many, many years, and ending up with a system that is very difficult to navigate.
Can I make a comment?
I'm sorry, Senator Morissette, Mons Astorling, I'm sorry.
I think it's very creative in under the financing of the Oregon Health Fund that you have addressed the medical liability.
Page 10B, or C.
Addressing the issue of medical liability.
That's one of the things I'm making recommendations about.
But I find it interesting putting it under the financing, the Oregon Health Fund program.
And the reason it was placed there
because of the
tremendous cost of defensive medicine.
This is Section 11.
What we've discussed at times. So you thought that was the best place to put it because it drives the cost of health care up. I'm sorry, Representative Grinley.
We'll be making recommendations about that.
Correct.
We didn't think that was creative at all. We thought that's just where it went.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, under Morissette.
I asked you about a week ago if we were going to be dealing with malpractice issues, and you said no.
I got overruled.
Good. That was one of the questions that came up from a constituent who was at the meeting in Springfield, and we are addressing it currently in Senate Bill 3183. And I think it would be appropriate in this new structure to, I'm not sure how we're going to address it in new structure, but we certainly should.
Well, Senator, Senate Bill 183 is one which I feel has great promise, not just for rural health delivery, but for the entire state. Senate Bill 183 is a program that was set up by the governor 4 years ago to subsidize primary care and obstetrical care in rural Oregon. There's been a little bit of an abuse at one point in it, which we're all fairly familiar with. I don't want to go back through it. It affects Ashland. But the system overall has worked extremely well. We've not lost providers in rural Oregon in the last 4 years, and we've actually gained some. That type of program has real value, and it would be a piece and parcel of this legislation. Further comments on
question
on this section? Yes.
Okay. Where in committee, especially in my committee, there is a huge amount of concern regarding the disparity in the minority populations, whether it's seniors or the disabled. You see that in disparities in access and health care. That then would come under your delivering health services. Is that correct?
That is correct. You know, we understand very clearly the disparities in health care in rural Oregon, have tried to address that at various times. There are also disparities in the inner cities of our state and in other areas. It's not just a matter of being rural. There's many areas where we can do and must do better. This plan hopefully will address that.
And we, if I may, Mr. Chair, we very specifically include language in several places throughout the bill that there be geographic and ethnic representation to the greatest extent possible, as well as including people with disabilities on the subgroups and work groups.
We also tried very carefully that the tribes were not impacted by this in a negative fashion. We want to enhance their programs. They have primary care funded at their reservations and one program in Portland for it. But they have very great difficulty in accessing specialty care, hospital care, and their funds are inadequate for mental health, drug, and alcohol. So we want to address that in a positive fashion, and we hope we've written this in a way that does that. We're not trying to in any way limit them.
I was sitting in Senator Mona Sanderson's committee the other day, and there was an interesting discussion about the medical home concept, which a number of people on the committee were not quite sure what a medical home was, which was interesting. That was a But the bill is moving along, and I believe CARE Oregon is part of that. And I think it's a great concept. And although we are doing it, I think the idea of a medical home where every individual has a medical home and is referred out to the various services is something that needs to be incorporated, and I'm sure it will be, particularly in rural Oregon, because that's where it's difficult for people to find a medical home. You have to go a long way for referral out and so on. And my feeling is we're going to have to fill some of the gaps in rural Oregon for services that may not exist right now. But the medical home idea, I think, are you familiar with that, Bill?
Absolutely. And I think it's a pilot program which starts to address a different way of delivering health care.
Yeah.
The kind that we believe we have to go to where it's preventative and primary first, and everything flows from that. And
well, that's mentioned under the efficient and effective delivery system model.
Correct. And we feel those subcommittees will have to address those very issues on a broader scale than just a pilot program in order for this to be successful in the long run.
Now, why would I ask a physician if he's familiar with the medical home idea?
Well, because this guy isn't always on top of things like he should be, okay? Spend too much time sitting in committee and trying to see patients when I go home.
Mr. Chair,
other questions?
A comment with regard to the medical home and some perhaps different approaches. Representative Maurer and Cannon, under the stewardship of Chair Greenlich, have come up with what I think is a very innovative piece of legislation that directs people into medical homes and has a, while it's not specifically stated in this bill, I think it is very complementary in regard to where individual citizens access, their point of access is primary care physicians. Is that a mischaracterization of?
We put together a bill that includes the medical home and the 100% access demonstrations and a little bit about the rural health clinics. We're trying to
community collaboratives.
Community collaboratives are creative.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes.
Section 11 has some detail about what the subcommittees are going to be looking at, but really the board's charge is to come up with a comprehensive plan that achieves the goals in Section 4. So in Section 4, you'll see that Subsection 1 is ensuring that all Oregonians have timely access to high-quality, effective, safe, patient-centered, evidence-based, and affordable health care. I think I hope that addresses Senator Moss-Anderson's concern. And then if you look at Subsection 4, which is at the top of page 7, it talks about delivery systems and even references there the primary care medical home model.
Thank you for pointing that out. The work that you've done, Representative Greenlich, in your committee is excellent. I had a quick look at it last night. I haven't looked at it completely. It's exactly where we want to go. It's exactly the kind of work that has to be done if we're going to get control of costs. And I think it's a wonderful piece of legislation, and we'll be glad to work with you on that.
All we have to do is figure out how to find $15 million bucks, and we'll.
I always have ideas for minor change.
Mr. Chair, have we discussed Section 10?
I'm not ready to leave Section 11.
I have one more point about Section 11 I want to look at, but we'll come back. We'll go on to 10 in just a moment. Senator Moss-Anderson.
I'm looking at page 12. This is still under Section 11, and we're starting to talk about health plans. And I've been a strong advocate of sort of this public-private relationship and insurance involved in this, and we're talking about setting up standards for the health plans, standards for the enrollment, disenrollment. It sounds like that every health insurer will have to have all of the same criteria. Give me a little bit of sense of where Blue Cross Blue Shield and all of the various other insurers are, how do they fit into this in page 12?
Page 12?
Yeah.
Is that where you're at? This, the language here is designed to allow the board to set up administrative rule by which you can prevent individuals coming to the state for one sole purpose, take part in a universal access system when they know they have a pre-existing condition and they come here for that reason only. It's also designed that if you come here from out of state and you have a job or a job waiting for you, you are not exempted or are prevented from getting health insurance either through your employer or on your own. We just can't allow the entire United States to feed patients here with pre-existing conditions that would swamp the system, nor do we want to prevent people from coming in who might have pre-existing conditions but already had insurance. We're moving here for other purposes. It might make it very difficult for employers. So we're trying to have language here that works both ways, and we believe we achieved that through legislative counsel. And so it might look a little obtuse, but that's the intent very clearly is.
It still doesn't, I'd forgotten that this is just addressing eligibility. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we also understand that pre-existing conditions for people inside the state, if everyone's insured, as Representative Grinlick pointed out, no longer is significant. We can risk these different policies so that nobody is caught in a situation where, as an accountable health plan, they're at risk. But the key thing here is to prevent us being swamped. Senator Morissette?
A little bit of follow-up then. Let's go to the financing of the Oregon Health Fund then.
Page
10. And we're, collecting employer and employee contributions and individual health care premium page 10.
This is line 4. Page 10, line 4.
Yeah, line 4. So a physician makes a claim. Who is he making the claim with? The health fund?
No, he'll go through an accountable health plan.
That's where I want to know. Where does the accountable health
plan start? Accountable health plan, self-insured, or if you have a plan that's not cautioning directly to the plan that exists now. I thank you for the segue, though, because the next point I wanted to bring up was lines on that page, lines 7, 8, 9. I want to make it very clear the language here is collecting the value of the public subsidy. This is not pending deductibility for employers. We are not doing that, or for individuals. Very, very clear. That language is very carefully crafted. And remember that we're asking them to look at proposals for doing this. And those proposals, as far as line 789, could vary dramatically from a payroll tax to contributions made in other ways, such as they've done in Massachusetts. So it's very open language. It's part of the proposal this board has come up with. They have to do actuarial work, see what level we have to make that fund work in order to get everybody into the system. But we are not ending deductibility in this bill. Okay. Senator Morissette, I think you had your hand up.
Well, it had to do with defining resident requirements. Now,
what page are you on?
Well, I'm back on page. Well, I lost my place. Verification. Well, somewhere else.
Lori, can you help us?
It was under. It has to do with residency requirements. Now, is there a standard residency requirement that we are going to use that already?
Page 12, line 7.
Understand, or are we verification requirements to ensure enrollees meet residency requirements?
The board's going to make recommendations.
Well,
that's all it says.
I understand that. But what I'm asking is there a standard residency requirement that currently exists for Medicare, Medicaid, for instance?
You you cannot, first off, as far as the Medicaid program is concerned, it's a federal program. You can't deny access to it as long as you're a legal resident of the United States. And this program would fall under the same general rule. What we're dealing with here...
Well, I meant the Oregon Health Plan more than the Medicaid. The Plus, for instance.
Well, HP Plus would be on the same requirements as OHP Plus and OHP Standard are both two different arms of the Medicaid program. What this is actually going to is people who are undocumented in this country. We have to deal with those individuals. They're here. They're working here. They're taking part in our state. And we're going to try to direct them as much as possible to safety net clinics and give safety net clinics help in dealing with that population. But at this point, this is a problem at the federal level. Until that is resolved at the federal level, I think we have to have pretty careful residence requirements, which would require that you be a resident of the United States and have a residency that is documented in the United States.
The reason I mention this is because there's liable to be pushback against this concept, this bill, unless we're very careful the way we deal with the residency issue. And I understand the federal requirements. I understand the cost shift. We're much better off serving people at the front end than in the emergency room where they really run up the bill. So this is going to be one of the most sensitive areas for a lot of people. In terms of acceptance, and I'm kind of wondering what other states have done in similar situations. The state of Massachusetts, have they addressed this issue?
I do not know if Massachusetts directly has. I know the border states are struggling with this. Their healthcare systems are having huge expenses because of this, where people cross the border for healthcare or deliveries, and it's a very, very difficult situation. I recognize we cannot resolve this at the state level. On the other hand, we can address it, and we are trying to address it here, that we are not going to open the plan up for universal access to undocumented individuals. At the same time, we're going to recognize the reality that they're here, okay, and try to refer them as much as possible to primary care through the safety net clinics as much as we can.
Mr. Chair?
I thought that's up to the board to make that recommendation.
If I could... The two comments. First of all, to the best of our knowledge, and we don't specifically know, but to the best of our knowledge, there are 175,000 undocumented workers in this state. That's A. B, as you so clearly indicated, they are here. C, and what's important for purposes of this bill and Mitch's comment with regard to the recommendation that the subcommittees make to the board and then bring back to the legislature for their consideration and hopeful approval, is that those individuals access the system now in exactly, by and large, the most expensive place on the face of the planet to receive medical care, the American emergency room. What I think is incumbent, at least would be my recommendation, and whatever participation I have in this subgroup, if any, would be that, A, we understand that, not wish or perception, but that fact, and that we allow a structure that is not only humane but is cost effective for all of the rest of us to be brought to the legislature for their consideration.
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree.
Senator Morse.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to come back to Section 11 again with respect to the categories. I know that we have stated in Section 4, subparagraph 4, use proven models of health care benefits, service delivery, and payments that control costs and overutilization. But I think the document can be strengthened if we were to add another section under Section 11. We have four of them now. We have financing, the delivery of health services, essential services, and eligibility requirements. If we added a fifth that was pertaining to medical inflation, I think the document, it's implied throughout this document that we need to drive to more cost-efficient methods and deliveries and utilizations. But absent changing that medical inflation curve, there is nothing that we can do in this bill that will work unless we can somehow flatten that. And I believe the document would be strengthened if we elevated that to the point in this subcommittee work to think critically about how do you change the inertia of the existing system. And that's a huge task.
I will take that under close advisement, and you can help me put some language together.
I've never seen
a fifth I didn't like, so adding a fifth is okay with me, all right?
Two comments, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Number one is that Section 11 is not prescriptive in any limiting way in terms of how many subcommittees. second comment with regard to Senator Morris's issue is that I think he really nailed the purpose and the intent of this bill and the board and the subcommittees and the thrust of this whole public policy thrust, which is overcoming the existing inertia of the current delivery system. That's what this is really trying to capture. I thought we did that pretty well in the delivery section, the B under 11. But if we need to beef that up in any way, shape, or we are more than happy to do that, whether that's the fifth section. But fundamentally, what Senator Morris just said is our task in this committee and in this bill. That's what this is really all about.
Senator Morris, page 9 under section 11, line 29 starts, the board shall establish subcommittees configured to maximize efficiency and effectiveness, develop recommendations for all the following, then we go through our four committees. Would you entertain language in there that would direct all four of those committees, the ones doing benefits, the one doing application, finance, that your language would be directed all four of those committees, overcoming inertia and flattening the curve of inflation, that all four committees were at this point instructed to work on their issues from that point of view? I mean, that's what we're trying to do.
I would agree with you. I believe that it's incorporated in the four subcategories we have now, but I think if we could strengthen it by a specific directive that it should be on the front end of this, maximize their efficiency and effectiveness.
That might be
language that specifically directs to flattening this medical inflation curve. And I don't know whether that's the right language. That's probably not the right language in a statute, but
I understand your meaning. And you're absolutely correct. And I think we can probably incorporate language in there, direct all four of these committees to focus on that. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to do. That's why we're here, is because of the unsustainable cost of health care. Poor outcomes and lack of access result from that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morissette.
You can start the paragraph by something like stop the cost shift. I mean, the best way to flatten the cost of health care is to put some of the money up front, which we've been trying to do forever, to mitigate some of the serious conditions that appear later on, but let's give cost shift legitimacy by assigning that as one of the tasks of this group. I think that's number one task. Think of all the money we can save if we put money into treatment of drug, alcohol, mental health instead of sending them to the emergency room, jails, prisons, and so on. Now, there's more to it than that, but I think that's basically the bottom line of a lot of our problems, is we don't invest at the right time. So I think it's a great idea to specifically address that issue.
We probably need more specific language. We'll make a note of that. Senator Mons Anderson.
No, yes, Section 11 again. I'm on page 11 at line 22 when we're talking about the design and implementation of a program to create a public partnership and with the accountable health plans. I assume the accountable health plans will be private. Is that true?
My expectation is they are.
Yes.
Now, let me sort of make sure we're talking the same thing. I consider the FCHIPs private. Others might not, but I consider the FCHIPs private. They are funded by Medicaid dollars, but they're run by private organizations, not directly by the state. They have some broad oversight by the state, but for the most part, the FCHIPs are run as individual public-private partnerships. I think that's why they're so effective.
I like the public piece because public implies complete transparency.
Frank.
Am I interpreting that right?
Correct.
Yes, thank you.
Can public
health is
public.
Public.
Not private.
Comments.
You know, I'd just like to echo something Senator Morissette said with regard to Medicaid, the FCHIPs, and federal requirements with regard to what the feds see as a national program. And it's one of the reasons that it's important in this bill that the Medicaid delivery system be, as we specifically address in here, those funds be segmented in the Oregon Health Trust Fund, and that the FCHIPs themselves be allowed to continue to deliver those services which they have so well delivered over the last 14 years. That is not something that is that we have overlooked in this, and that the FCHIPs be allowed to continue to do the same excellent work they have done for so many years.
And thank you for that comment. We mentioned that earlier at the beginning of this, and we want to make sure we look at the statutes to make sure we have not simply by oversight not set that up properly. And so I'll go back to the ORSs with you at a later time, Lori.
Okay. Chair, I did notice that it was in the old Senate Bill 329, Section 9, and it's not in this draft, but we can certainly make sure that's in there.
You mean there's going to be a dash 3?
Mm-hmm. No.
4?
39.
We have bets on where we're going to end up on this, but we won't tell you what numbers we've chosen as the final drafts. Representative Greenleaf.
Are we done with Section 11?
Well, for this, I think we are for this evening, potentially, okay?
You want to talk about some other stuff?
We're not through this bill yet. Anything else on 11?
Mr. Chair, very quickly, it would be helpful to me as we proceed to have clearly in my mind how the intent and purpose of this board is distinct from the original intent and purpose and goals of the Oregon Health Plan. Now, I know one of the big differences is that we're talking about a lot of private dollars that are potentially going into this insurance exchange. But when I look at Section 11, I see that, you know, eligibility requirements, essential health services, a sort of prioritized list. I think the Oregon Health Plan did not intend to get into delivery to any substantial degree. I don't know, it wasn't here. But and financing, obviously, is different here. But if we could, I guess when I put on the skeptic's cap, I think, well, this is just sort of going at OHP with new vigor and new energy and maybe more dollars.
Let me try to answer that for. I'm sorry.
Well, in a sense, that's correct. The original OHP had three legs in it: the Medicaid reform, the high-risk pool, and a movement towards universal access that came out of HB 935. That bill was passed in 89 and killed in 91, and we were left with two legs of a stool, which never could work. This is. what we sort of had in mind.
In many ways it is, but there's an exception to this that's really, really important. I know this Senate Bill 27, the original one, and the Oregon Health Plan was a bit before your time. I think you were still a gleam in your father's eye at that time. But for those of us who are still around then, the original plan was three legs of stool, as outlined. The mandate on employers to have health insurance benefits for their employees was probably going to be challenged in court as an ERISA violation, but it was rescinded by the legislation. There were things in it that there were tax breaks for doing it and much of other stuff we'll get into. What it assumed in that plan was, one, that you have a limited amount of resources you want to spread as far as you can through a prioritized list. What it assumed, though, also was that the basic delivery system in place was efficient, effective, and adequate. This bill assumes that's not the case. This bill says our present delivery system has huge flaws in it, primarily the flaw being that we have come over the last 20 years to depend more and more and more on end of illness, not end of life, end of illness high-tech care. And we do not put anything of significance into preventative measures and primary care to prevent the need for very expensive use of high-tech. And until we start doing that, as other industrialized countries do, we will see an escalation of our health care costs, which we cannot afford. That's the one significant difference I see in this, other than what we saw in OHP back in 92?
88.
I got on board a year after you did.
88 was the commission. It went to the 89 legislature.
89
and changed in 91.
And 89 is when I got involved, so... That's the big difference that I see, is we're challenging the delivery system for the first time to change.
I don't agree with your definition of the problem, but you're right about the delivery system being screwed up.
Thank you.
I don't think it is last year of life.
Getting you to
increase technology across everything, that's the issue.
Correct. Getting you to agree with me on almost anything I consider a victory.
I agree with you on almost everything.
Section 11.
Different sections yet?
I'm sorry. What?
Are you ready to talk about other sections yet?
We're still on
11.
Okay.
Okay.
Page 10.
When should I come back to have other sections?
No. Don't forget.
Okay. Page 10, line 7. My favorite concept is not here by name. The exchange. Is this the exchange? Be collecting and value of public.
No, that is not the exchange.
Where is the exchange in this bill?
It is here. Let me find it for you.
Okay.
Lori, can you help me? It was supposed to be here anyway.
Page 11.
Page 11.
Starts on 28, 29, 30. Goes over slightly to page 12.
Oh, okay. Health insurance exchange. Okay. Very good.
You know, Mitch is just down there being very reserved.
I can wait.
Before his blood pressure goes off the map.
Before his knees start to swell.
Mitch, Senator Greenleaf, would you bring up your next question, please?
He demoted me.
Oh, Senator Representative Greenleaf. I'm sorry. I just elevated you again back to the House.
Right. I mean, Section 11 is great, and it gives a long list of things the committee ought to make recommendations, but there's basically no teeth and no substance to anything in Section 11. Where there is substance is in Section 10 and in Section 14 and 15, I think, where something is actually created. Section 10 creates a fund, and it looks like it's supposed to start collecting money. Is that right? Before we get any of those recommendations about what it should collect. I mean, it looks like that. And then there's the section, I assume that's what's intended, so by the time the board figures out what to do, there's a big fat dowry that can really get going. That would be
the
nice.
The board is not empowered to collect any funds. It's empowered
sure
to set up a fund.
Well, you don't read Section 10 saying the board's empowered to...
Lori, can you help me here?
Yes. Section 10 creates the framework for a fund. It's kind of like a skeleton framework for the fund so that the money at some point could go into it. But at before it goes through the legislative process in 09, the only thing that's going to be in the fund would be any money that's appropriated, any general fund that's appropriated under Section 21. I think it's 21.
Where does it say that, Laurie? I mean, it says, you didn't tell us what to do with the interest earnings. The fund is established, and it shall consist of. Yeah.
Chair Bates, Representative Greenlick, we have a lot of funds that have nothing in them.
It's just like at home. It's the same problem. Okay.
I think it says shall, and I take that as may and will. But I don't see anything here says that these funds will be collected immediately. But I may be missing. It is not the intent to set this fund up and fund it immediately. It's to set it up, ready for funding with report to the legislature, and the legislature makes the final decision in January, February, March of 09, with information supplied by the board what those funds would be necessary and what they would do, and then we have to convince the legislature it's the right thing to do.
Well, what about the money to run the other programs we've given the board? The Office of Health Policy, the Certificate of Need, something about a Center of Excellence or something? Is that not intended?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Greenlick, the idea is that this would go through a ways and means process, just like other bills that have other than general fund appropriations. And so it doesn't have to be explicit in this bill, but it's there as a repository.
It would be other fund ways and means stuff, huh?
It could be other funds. It could be general fund. Could be gifts, grants.
But the things that come under the board now are in section what, 13 or something? And 14, they.
Laurie, could you, Laurie, just for a second, on page 9, lines 18 and 19. I assume that is the money we're talking about from the point of view of what's put into the fund for the administrative cost of this board. Would that also include the money that's been coming over with OPR and other organizations? that language cover that? Or is that covered somewhere else in the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how OPR is funded. I don't know if it's all general fund, but whatever's decided as needed would carry over and just be going to this fund. The only thing that changes about the Office of Oregon Health Policy is that it's now under the trust board, but it's still its operations are the same. So to the extent that a fund is created to operate the trust board, then the monies would have to be transferred over through the ways and means process.
The same way, huh?
Representative Greenlick, you're absolutely correct. This board is not just one for another commission out there planning and designing a plan. It has immediate responsibilities. Now, those are OOPR and certificate of need would be moved onto this board immediately. That is one this bill authorizes them to have authority over.
And there's the formation of a center of excellence or something, is that right? I had it and lost it.
Is that part of OOPR?
Mr. Chair, the Office of Oregon Health Policy is to establish a five-year plan for evaluation and make a proposal for a quality initiative, which comes out of the Health Policy Commission's recommendation. And
it talks somewhere about the creation of a quality center.
Quality Institute.
Quality Institute.
That's in Section 14.
Right.
And the Quality Institute is, where is it? On nine. Page 15, line 9.
We need to have some way to look and see if this board is doing what we want to do.
Well, this is independent of the evaluation plan, I think, isn't it? Or is it a part of the evaluation plan's in one. Is this included in that?
Laurie?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think these are just two charges that are made to the Office of Health Policy, and one is to come up with a five-year evaluation plan, and two is to come up with a model for a quality institute. Although the bill is silent on what they're supposed to do when they come up with the model.
Another proposal.
We're trying to get an ongoing process here that will continue to try to improve the healthcare system. This is not something you just plug in and everything's fixed for the next 50 years. We don't want to fall back in that trap again.
Mr. Chair, presumably since the Office of Health Policy would now be under the board, that would be an evolving process, and I presume they would, if they needed additional funding, that would again come back through the Ways and Means process.
I'm going to ask that Dr. Smith come up just for a moment and ruin her evening. You step up to the microphone and identify yourself just for a moment.
For the record, this is Janine Smith, the perhaps the last administrator of the Office of Health Policy.
You are just getting started. I wonder if you take a moment, and we selected your office to come over out of DAS because we felt that what you do in Uber is so germane to what this board is going to do, and the expertise you bring and the committees you bring with it are vital to them functioning properly. I'd like to give us a quick outline of the agency, what's under that agency, the kind of things you do with the agency, so we can have a clearer picture of why we want this to broaden the authority of the board. And you can give us your opinion what you think about moving, too.
Senator Bates and Westland and the committee, the Office of Health Policy was established back in the early days of the Oregon Health Plan just to be separate from the Department of Human Services so it could be an outside neutral body that could evaluate what was going to happen with the Oregon Health Plan, which at that time was to be global broad healthcare reform. We have various statutory responsibilities, including we staff the Health Services Commission, which is the ones that do the prioritized list. We staff the Health Resources Commission, which does the evidence-based drug review information that goes to the Medicaid agency to make the preferred drug list, and also does some medical technology assessments. We have the Health Policy Commission, which was set up and altered from the original Health Council, includes four legislators to make a strategic health plan for the state. We have a data requirements statutorily. We collect the hospital financials, the have done hospital quality evaluations. We collect, we do data collection for the part of DHS looking at nursing facilities and outpatient home nursing alternative to nursing facilities. I'm blanking on the name. And the foster care and assisted living centers. And we feed that information back to the to DHS. We also staff the Medicaid Advisory Committee in collaboration with the Department of Human Services Division of Medicaid Medical Assistance. We also staff the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which is the bulk purchasing program, and that is also falls under our budget. And we do then, of course, directly provide information to the legislature and the governor on health care trends. We do a regular report that you just received on overall health care trends in the state, hospital trends as well. We also collaborate with the outside researchers through the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative. Our funding is general fund, which where we can, we get Medicaid match, which has played a large portion of our budget. In past years, we've had a very minimal amount of general fund, and we've tried to make that up with federal and other private grants, which have dried up, and we are been our current budget that went through Ways and Means via DAFs includes some additional general fund to try to catch up for the fact that these federal funds have dried up so that we can continue to operate all of those services. And I would also add, we also have been able to contract for about the last year with Dr. Jody Pettit to be the state health information technology coordinator in trying to get interconnectivity for electronic medical records and working on privacy and security issues related to electronic health exchange. I'm sure there's a few things I left off.
I think you've done a very good job off the cuff.
We sit around a lot and don't do anything. Yeah. But
so, sometimes I get the best testimony from people who have not a chance to prepare because they really hit the important things they do, and I appreciate your testimony tonight. Just one quick question. Well, two, really. How big is your department?
We have a staff of approximately 20 individuals.
And how much effort are you able to put into assessing medical technology?
The Health Resources Commission has had various, we have, I don't know, 17 subcommittees on each class of drugs and has done fairly extensive medical technology assessments in terms of pharmaceuticals. We've not had a lot of funding to do really extensive medical technology assessments beyond that in the last several years that I've been there.
Thank you. I think that's something that we'll be looking forward to seeing more work being done on. There's a lot of medical technology being done right now without good outcome data. We do it because it seems appropriate. It's expensive. And I think we need someone who's objective to look at that, not just be going out and doing it. So I look forward to you working with the board. I hope you do, too.
She did not answer that question.
Oh, she didn't. She's very politically astute.
Dr. Smith, what's your total budget? Total funds?
It's approximately about $5 million, but that includes matching dollars with the Medicaid dollars.
Do you have anything to do with certificate of need?
Representative Greenlake, no. That is housed in the Department of Human Services in the Public Health Division. And
thank you.
Follow up on that. And maybe you can help me out on this question regarding what you do. And Oregon is very well known for its evidence-based research that's housed right now at OHSU. And sort of dovetailing with what this Senator Morse was saying regarding trying to take care of this medical inflation, where does, I mean, evidence-based outcomes, utilization, and we've talked about that in this committee. I'm trying to figure, to me it seems that it would fit into maybe Quality Institute, but I just need a little help regarding where that piece is here.
Senator Mona Anderson and Chair Bates and Westland, the health resources statute defines medical technology assessments to look at the best evidence and bring that back and then to allow policymakers then to make decisions about whether they're going to fund that technology. In the instance of prescription drugs, we through a multi-state consortium, which we didn't have initially. We did it ourselves with the OHSU. But now there's about 24 states that pitch in together to buy these evidence-based reviews on a particular drug class. And then we take it back to the subcommittee of the Health Resources Commission, which is made up of physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and consumers, and they look at the evidence and decide what's the best recommendation for Oregon, just like people in Washington State do that and other states in the country. And then those recommendations are passed through the full resource commission, equally sort of a balance. They're all volunteers. They put in numerous hours reviewing these very lengthy, detailed reports that come from OHSU and translate them down to a more readable report that is then the highlights are supposedly more readable and put on our website, plus on a consumer-focused website.
I understand what you've done with prescription drugs, but I'm looking at other
And, well, originally, before there was such a focus on drugs, they did look at medical technology back in the, probably about 5-6 years ago, just before I came. They hadn't really done the detailed drug evals. They did more medical technology like scanners and gamma, you know, that sort of thing. And they haven't, they sort of got really focused on the drugs because that was such a big cost driver in Medicaid program.
To answer, I think I'm going to try to drive an answer here for you. We're looking at technology now that is not being looked at anymore, whether it's stents, whether it's pacemakers and what kind of pacemakers, defibrillators you might implant in somebody, whether it's bone transplants. We recently had an issue in this country where bone transplants and pieces of bone were sent out that had not been properly identified and tagged, and some of those bones were infected that were being implanted in people. These are technology problems that are huge. What kind of knee is the best knee to replace? What's the cost of that knee? What's the cost effectiveness of that knee? Hips the same way. New discs for backs. You know, whether or not you do aortic bypasses or whether you do
The Health Resources Commission just did look at bariatric surgery and then made those recommendations on to the Health Services Commission to decide if they're going to incorporate that into the prioritized list.
So first the work has to be done, and it has to be done, I believe, by a neutral body. Best outcome is then determined and then passed to a board that has real ability to help insurers decide what should be and what should not be paid for. I believe, frankly, the insurers are caught in a trap in these things. It's a demand placed on them by the industry. They don't have, I don't think, the real resources to decide whether a certain instrument or technology has real value or not. They just have to make the best decision they can. This under the board gives them, I think, much more direction that way. Senator Morse, do you have a question?
I did, but I'm changing the subject. Thank you for your comments.
Completed.
Well, if we're done, I want to get back to Representative Greenlech's concern.
Dr. Smith's consideration.
Yes.
There's a young lady in the second to the back row that held up a hastily crafted cardboard sign that said, "I can't wait to move."
Now she's denying it. And she's
Look at that.
And she's eating cardboard.
Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. I know it was kind of on the spot, but I wanted to get more information out. Thank you.
If I may, an issue that I believe would be a red flag issue for certain members in the Assembly, and that gets back to Section 13 and the issue that Representative Greenlech raised. It's very clear that Section 13, Subsection 1, is that the board will finalize a comprehensive plan and deliver it to the Legislative Assembly and the governor no later than October 1 of 2008. And then it says that upon legislative approval, the board will be authorized to request federal waivers and, you know, necessary and appropriate to implement the plan. Subsection 3, though, is a red flag, I believe, that we need to clarify, and that is the statement that the board is authorized to implement any elements of the plan as appropriate that do not require legislative changes or federal approval. And the way I read these three subsections is that we're partially pregnant, and that there may be things that are set in motion that, in fact, could be reversed as the legislature then takes up the final plan. And I wonder if that language could be clarified with respect to the board is authorized to implement anything that is necessary to create the plan as opposed to implementing the plan. Because I see this as a real red flag that would be of concern to members, that we're setting things in motion before we've actually determined what it is we're setting in motion and have given the blessing of the legislature and the governor to that final plan.
I see your concern, and the intent here is to allow the board to do what it can now to try to establish things such as medical home, primary care, that people do SafeNet clinics. There might be a much better way to limit that. I recognize it's a very broad statement. It might go into areas we had not thought of. So I think your point is well taken. Let us consider that a little bit longer. Thank you.
Lori, do you have a comment? I mean, I understand this is in here very forthrightly. There's not any attempt to do more than they're allowed to do. Do you have a comment on that sub 3?
Yes, Chair Westland. The subsection 3, there are sort of two limits on it. One is they have to be changes that are appropriate. So the idea, I think, is you're not going to start down a path to implement something that you're going to then have to reverse course on. The second is that it's something that does not require legislative change. Therefore, it would have to be something on which the legislature doesn't really have a strong policy direction that's in statute. So the idea would be that it would be something more minor, perhaps the portable electronic medical records or something of that nature that isn't already embodied in a statutory policy.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, we members in the Assembly have active imaginations. And for those that are skeptics of Senate Bill 329, that is a red flag with respect to how far is this board empowered to go.
Senator Morris, I take that as an excellent criticism, and I will dedicate myself to giving some different language there. I think you've got a good point. Lori, just a real quick question on that same page, line just above it. And the request for federal waivers, 14, 15, and 16. Is there any way that could be construed that would include any federal waivers concerning Medicare? If the board deemed it necessary to affect Medicare, will this give them authority to ask for those kind of waivers? We don't want that in there if that's the case. They have to be able to go forward with waivers concerning Medicaid and some other potential issues. There's only one possible Medicare waiver I could ever think of that we would want them to do, and that's requesting that we get the average reimbursement that is available in the United States, not that we'd be at the bottom of the pile. But could that be construed to mean that we could go after Medicare waivers, line 15?
If federal law changed to allow federal waivers of Medicare, as is envisioned in this bill, then yeah, that would be broad enough. So the language could be changed to make it clear that it would not.
At the present time,
they would not have the authority.
At the present time, there's no waiver. There's no way of waivering anything in Medicare. We understand that. Whether we need to leave that language in or adjust it, I don't know.
Did I hear Lori say that currently there's no federal provision to allow for a Medicare waiver?
Correct. We take an act of Congress to change and allow a waiver to be applied for. That is not there.
There are
now
certain waivers allowed under Medicare. They're experimental waivers. They're not this kind of
thing. Closed down, 646.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, they closed the window on that last January. Before.
Medicare demonstrations?
Yes. We checked it out, and what we found from CMS, that was closed down, I think, January of 05 or 06.
Chair Bates, I think there were two application deadlines, and the last one was in September of 05 for the Medicare Quality Health Initiative.
Senator Greenlee, if we're in error, we will certainly look at that.
I mean, I don't think they're talking about waivers like this, but they have demonstration projects to find out whether they should add this to Medicare or not to Medicare. They have a variety of things. As recently as a year and a half ago, we had a demonstration agenda but maybe well, not, but certainly not for something like this.
Well, I just want to be certain that we're very clear that we're not asking for any Medicare waivers here in this part of the bill and that we haven't tried to slip something in or inadvertently done something we didn't mean to, okay? Be very clear about
yeah, Mr.
That.
Chair, we can change that to make that explicit, that it does not include Title 18.
Okay. I think that'd be, that might be worthwhile. Committee, it's 7 o'clock. I'm sure we're all tired and don't want to go on any longer. We need to. And for those of you in the audience that are either listening or here tonight, I expect that this will generate some discussion and I would ask that that you do two things. We will have hearings, but I'd like to have, if possible, any of your concerns in writing prior to the next hearing, which will be Wednesday. So we have a chance to look at those concerns and be thoughtful about it and be ready to reply, if possible, to you. This is a sweeping bill. There's a lot in it, and if we're going to change health care in this state, we've got to move forward. I think there's something for everybody to like in this bill and probably something for everyone to hate in this bill. But remember, if you would please, that first we're Oregonians, secondly we're advocates. And I would hope that we, people will look at it from that point of view. If we do nothing, we fail. If we do nothing, we fail. So let's move forward.
Well, and third, Mr. Chair, we're all consumers of health care. And I would like to echo some of your remarks. After tonight's hearing, which I thought was excellent, we have 5 committee hearings left. Time is of the essence. So when Dr. Bates said, please get us your comments, critiques, concerns by next committee hearing or as soon thereafter as possible, he's not kidding.
We've delayed this
hearing for
6 weeks.
A deliberative process that did not come to fruition. We are tired of that debate. This is what we've got. I'm very proud of it. I think all the members of the committee should be proud of our input in getting us this far. But we have little time left to complete a significant task for this legislature.
I'm happy to put on the record my continued perplexity about including certificate of need in this process.
I'm not hearing tonight very well. I'm sorry.
My continued perplexity about putting CON in this into this process. The board is going to have a gigantic job, as you know, creating a new health plan. And I understand why to put the Office of Health Policy and Research because they're an asset, and it makes some sense to get the kind of asset it is. But I think putting certificate of need is an anchor. You know, I can't see how it at this point how it adds anything to the ability of that board to do a very difficult and complex job. Because in fact, passing this isn't improving health care. Passing this is moving a process to plan for how to improve health care. It seems to me the last thing that board needs is something like certificate of need, which has been a disaster from the beginning.
I would offer that you may well be right. I'd also offer, however, that absolutely massive bureaucracy we're bringing over for a certificate of need, which is
0.75
FTE may not be a huge difficulty for the board. My point being that we do not have...
But it's bringing a task over. I mean, we are going to get to the question, if we're doing that, as to why St. Vincent's is doubling its size, why Kaiser's building a facility 2 miles away from St. Vincent's while St. Vincent's is doubling its size. I mean, there are CON questions.
Absolutely. And if for no other reason, bringing it over so that discussion can occur, I think highlights what we want to have happen. You commonly will hear the certificate of needs programs do not work. They aren't cost effective. They actually drive costs up. That may well be the case. There is some evidence they don't. But when you're looking at a $20 billion a year industry, which we have in our wisdom decided to fund with 0.75 FTE and $146,000 every 2 years, if the same legislative assembly has set up a medical marijuana program with nine people in it, and how many million?
1.7 million
in it. I think we have some priorities we have to consider here that are not correct.
Well, medical marijuana probably does some good for some people. Certificate of need has never done a bit of good for anybody in this state.
Well, I would offer that if you have pneumonia and I want to give you penicillin and I tell you you'll need, 1,500 grams a day, but I'm only going to give you 5 grams a day, you're going to tell me that penicillin doesn't work. And it may be that it's the wrong drug, and maybe it's the wrong dose. We'll find out.
No, we won't.
Maybe we will. Thank you. Committee, anything else? Okay. We are adjourned. Thank you very much for your time tonight.